It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a selection of comments from a panel discussion last evening that I moderated with Lynn Hicks of the Des Moines Register, hosted by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. The discussion marks Governor Terry Branstad's transition to U.S. Ambassador to China. It was titled China, Iowa, and Diplomacy in the Trump Administration. Panel members included former U.S. Ambassadors Mary Kramer and Ron McMullen, Bill Niebuhr, President and CEO of Origin Agritech, and University of Iowa Professor of Political Science and International Studies Wenfang Tang. The discussion began by having Wenfang Tang point out the hot-button issues in the region.
The first one is North Korea. That's the hottest issue in the media in the past couple of weeks. The problem here is the U.S. thinks that China can solve the problem, and China says, no, it's really your problem. We can't really solve the North Korea problem and stop their missile and nuclear programs. The second issue is South China Sea. That's another hot issue. China considers South China Sea as part of China. But the U.S. think that it's international water. The third issue is Taiwan, which China thinks is part of China, President Trump shocked the world when he first got elected by answering a phone call from the Taiwanese president. No other, since the late 70s, no other U.S. president has ever done that. The other hot issue, it used to be hot, no longer hot, is the currency manipulation issue, right? If you remember during the campaign, and candidate Trump repeatedly said he's going to name China currency manipulator from day one. But he hasn't done so, and lately he told the media that China is helping the U.S. with North Korea, so he's not going to label China currency manipulator anymore. So the final issue, hottest issue, maybe it's not as hot. If you listen to the confirmation hearing, actually, for Governor Branstad, and that came up as a hot issue, as human rights. That issue seems to be missing, actually, during the presidential campaign. Even it came up during the confirmation hearing, I suspect that it's also probably is going to be in the back burner for a while.
From Professor Wenfang Tang, we move over to Bill Niebuhr, who has our business perspective, distinctly business perspective, who dealt a tremendous amount of time in China. Summarize what you see in this conversation, and we'll just make sure you bring out the fact that you have done in China what is known here as the full Grassley. You've visited not 99 counties in Iowa, but how many provinces in China?
Well, 34 that consider themselves autonomous.
Okay.
And independent. But agriculture and agribusiness, as well as business, is really at a pivotal moment in the history of our two countries. We have been connected for a long time, but it now is moving to an interdependency and intertwining of our reliance on each other. In the agribusiness sector, we have experienced from rural China to urban China the greatest migration of humankind in the history of the world. We have depopulated China the same way we've depopulated Iowa, on a grander scale. And we've asked fewer and fewer individuals to feed more and more. And it is impossible to do that without a modernization effort. So I'll speak to you tonight as an agriculturalist first, a business person second, and an Iowan third. And we'll bring that back to our phenomenal opportunity that we have today with an ambassador, our most important ambassador, I would argue, coming from our home state.
Thank you, Bill Niebuhr. We'll move to Mary Kramer. As a former ambassador, would you share your thoughts on this topic?
I am happy to be here, and thank you all for coming to listen. I am a person that has an opinion about just about everything, and it's wonderful when someone asks me to share that. So we'll start that way. I had some memories yesterday because of my own hearing at the Foreign Relations Committee, and not necessarily the substance, but as I sat down in the big, black, tufted leather chair, I realized the chair is on a marble floor and my feet don't touch the floor. So I spent my entire hearing hanging onto the table in case the chair took me somewhere I didn't want to go. I come from the position of the woman from Iowa who unexpectedly was asked to serve as the ambassador to Barbados in the Eastern Caribbean. When Bill speaks about, when we speak about the full Grassley, for me that was seven small nations, not 34 huge provinces. Nevertheless, each of them is governed, and part of the important role of the ambassador of the United States is to build a trust relationship with those elected officials. So when we need to talk to each other, whether it be on a happy topic or a not so happy topic, we are able to do that. It's a matter of finding even a little piece of common ground that we can both stand on and then see how we can expand that to get to where we're both feeling the win.
Unlike Ambassador Kramer, Ambassador Ron McMullen is a career diplomat. So we have two ambassadors, but quite different perspectives. Tell us, what is your view, Ron?
I agree with Bill that the relationship between China and the United States is going to be the most important bilateral relationship for the 21st century and beyond. So Governor Branstad is going to play a key role in cementing a cooperative, I think, mutually beneficial relationship if things go the way he wants them to. Now, to be a successful ambassador, Governor Branstad will have to do at least five things well. He'll have to be a manager. He'll have to manage this important bilateral relationship, but he also has to manage people, things, and money. Governor Branstad, who has had executive managerial experience as governor of Iowa for over 22 years, will be a natural at this. He is a good manager. He manages people, things, and money well. When the first Iowan to be ambassador to China served as ambassador, Edwin Conger from Dallas County, when he was there, he had a staff of four. Governor Branstad will have a staff of over 2,000. Wuhan, where one of our consulates is about as far from Beijing as Tallahassee, Florida is from Des Moines. So there'll be some geographic dispersion, 30 agencies, 2,000 people, the vast majority of whom will be Chinese citizens. So it will create new management challenges for the ambassador. The second thing that he'll have to succeed at is to be a persuader. Former Secretary of State said that diplomacy is persuasion in the shadow of power. Without power, diplomacy is just naked pleading. So Governor Branstad, as ambassador, will need to persuade the government of China, the people of China, and also third parties to find common interest in American interest and American values that are his job to promote these in China to both the government and to the people of China. He also has to be an advisor. While policy comes from Washington, policymakers in Washington traditionally have relied on the ambassador's advice from the field, the person who's wickered into the nerve center of that country, to be the key policy advisor for relations on that country. So Governor Branstad is going to have a real challenge because there are almost no senior appointments made in the State Department yet. There's also another node of influence with Jared Kushner being asked by President Trump to be his policy advisor on China. So how Ambassador Branstad is going to advise Washington is it's going to be tricky. I'm sure he'll work it out, but it's not apparent how that's going to happen. A fourth thing is he has to be a host. Terry and Chris Branstad will probably host 20 to 25,000 people to their residence in the next 3 years. Every congressional delegation that comes through will want a reception at the ambassador's. The American embassy community will want to have Thanksgiving at the ambassador's. official Chinese delegations coming in from the provinces will want to meet at the ambassador's residence. A lot of people visit Terrace Hill, beautiful governor's residence here in Des Moines, but they don't all expect to be met at the front door and to shake hands with Governor Branstad. So that will be a challenge for both Chris and Terry Branstad to host 20 or 25,000 people and to be the face and the persona of America in China for so many people. And lastly, he'll need to be a hard target. American diplomats walk around with a big bullseye painted on their back. Terrorists try to assassinate and kidnap ambassadors. Wackos do the same. North Korea in the past has targeted and successfully assassinated statesmen from other countries. So not only will he have a target on his back, but the governor, ambassador, will be the target of espionage organizations throughout the world. China's many espionage organizations will target him personally. His car, his house, his domestic staff, his professional staff, his telecommunications, everything that he and Chris talk about over dinner needs to be carefully screened for classified information. So we hope that that Ambassador Branstad will be a hard target and will have to reach a balance between staying in that security bubble and getting out and meeting Chinese and American people across China to be able to be the best persuader he can be.
Thank you, Ron. Bill, we're going to start with you with a question. I know that you have met with Governor Branstad and he has sought out your advice. So I'm curious, what did you tell him about what he should expect in this job and in China?
I've had the opportunity. I moved to Beijing in 2010 and lived there until late in 2015, early 2016. I had the opportunity on multiple occasions to meet with the governor under different auspices of the trade missions or political process or even agricultural missions. And we talked a lot about the differences and the challenges of effectively communicating on issues where we agree as well as issues where we choose that we understand that we don't agree. And we talked about the choice of verbiage. And there's a lot of question today on how the ambassador will confront on this issue or that issue. And confrontation in China is not always a very effective strategy. There's a great Chinese saying that it's impossible to slap a smiling face. And so as one positions themselves, and we talked about this, on finding areas of mutual interest and agreeing quickly on those and deeply on those so that we have the ability to expand into the adjacencies that exist where we disagree. And that we talked a lot about the importance of listening with Chinese ears and interpreting and extrapolating with an international mindset, and that you don't have much time to develop that, but at the same time, you can't hurry it. The challenges that we talked about were on timeline. How can we get the things done that we need to get done, but not push them so hard that they break? And then finally, we talked about life in Beijing and what it was like to live in an air quality situation such as Beijing today, or a traffic situation. And it's a hard situation. It's very, and I have to tell you, having moved back to Iowa, I didn't appreciate how fortunate we are in the quality of life that we enjoy. And so we've had far-ranging conversations, and I hope that some of it's had some beneficial impact.
Bill, you said listening with Chinese ears. That's an interesting perspective to have to take up. Let's focus in on this president. We have been listening with American ears to this president for over 100 days now, with various reactions to what has been said. I'm curious, Wenfeng, what are the Chinese making of our new president at this moment?
It really depends on what the president says about China. And if you go back to the presidential campaign last year when he was bashing China. He wasn't very popular at all. But then recently he met with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, in Florida. And then he became very popular. And I do actually have a few quotes from Chinese internet users commenting on President Trump. I like this old dude more and more. He's super smart. I'm getting to all of a sudden, I really like this guy. He's so honest and straightforward. Trump's English is easy to follow. He speaks slowly, and his speech should be used as English lessons for listening materials. I really like him. He doesn't put around the bush, and this guy cannot be overlooked easily if he raised such excellent children and if he created such a successful company.
But it's so fascinating that you have these Chinese people for the first time believe that they can have a relationship via tweets with the president of the United States.
Exactly.
It's just unprecedented.
Thanks, Bill. And you talked about relationships, and that's so important in China. And Ron, I wanted you to talk a little bit about what we heard a lot in the hearing is Governor Branstad's relationship with President Xi Jinping. And how important is that, and how will that matter when he's in the job?
There's an old saying in diplomacy that relationships are not made in a crisis. So let's imagine in 2 months that there's a collision in the South China Sea, an American warship hits a Chinese fishing vessel, and the fishing vessel sinks. Suddenly, alarms are going off in all across Southeast Asia, in China, and in the United States. Ambassador Branstad will be able to have access to the highest parts of the Chinese government, I believe, because he has a relationship established now with President Xi. Other senior leaders will give Ambassador Branstad better access than almost anybody else, and I think that's why President Trump appointed him.
Mary Kramer, perhaps you could talk about the relationship of an ambassador to a president. You had a relationship with George W. Bush. Do you have direct contact with a president? Do you have to go through channels? What do you expect Governor Branstad, soon to be ambassador, will encounter in terms of a relationship with this president?
In terms of being a politically appointed ambassador, two things I thought gave me credibility at the very beginning. One is I had run for office, been elected, so I understood the pressures that go with political campaigns and the problem of dealing with multi-opinions in constituencies. The other is not so much that I had a relationship with the president, but the fact that I was appointed by that president, given a mission to accomplish by that president, and that I could reach out and talk to that president if I needed to.
Did you talk with the president often?
Yes, I did.
Do you have an instance to recount?
I do. It's lovely to be out of diplomacy now, so I don't have quite as many filters as I have had in the past. There was a new embassy under construction in Bridgetown, Barbados. And it was a bit of a euphemism. It had been under construction for 9 years. And so most of the island thought it was kind of the joke that we were never going to finish it. And I became impatient because the location where we were was environmentally awful. I was sending people home in respiratory distress. I cannot live with that. So I called the White House. And it was a shock to everybody. But we got the thing turned around, and 8 months later, we completed the embassy building. I don't think I'd want to pull that trigger very often, but I thought it was enough of a problem that it was worth doing that one time. And I think that would be especially important to the Chinese to know that the ambassador not only has a relationship with their president, but he also has a relationship with the president of the United States.
Bill, you want to elaborate on that? Because I think you were talking about the importance of the relationship to Governor Ransom's relationship to Xi as well as President Trump.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance on how you manage your Guanxi or your connectivity or your relationships. You really have to treat this as a fixed asset. There's just a fixed amount of utilization that I can have, and so that I'll pull it out when I need that help. For the embassy team, the governor's relationship with the president is extraordinarily important for them to be able to accomplish their mission. They need to know that the president has the ambassador's back. And at the most recent governor's luncheon in Kansas City, the president called out the ambassador, the nominated ambassador, four times on four occasions using Governor Branstad as an example. And this was not missed by the Chinese nor the embassy staff. And I know the embassy staff after 5 years there very, very well and very intimately, and they're excited about this appointment. They believe that this is an appointment that the president has made for the right reasons. And maybe just a side on that, you know, as we come to food, food is something that the governor understands extraordinarily well, and trade equally. And these two issues, while on some of the hot lists and not on some of the others, are fundamental and foundational to a country of 1.4 billion. In my first meeting in China with our joint venture president, we had a conversation and he said, Dr. Niebuhr, have you ever been hungry? As we were debating an issue and policy. And I said, no, I grew up on a farm and I always had food. And he said, well, then, would you accept that you and I will never think about food the same way? And I think that gets to the core of our building a relationship with this emerging superpower, is that their fundamental problems historically in terms of revolutions have all been started by angry farmers who are hungry and who had no opportunity. And so as we move forward, our governor and our next ambassador has such an enormous experience base and constituency base to pull from to help the Chinese make that transition from where we were in the 20s and 30s in this state to where they want to be in the 20s and 30s in their century.
Our panel discussion, recorded last night, titled China, Iowa, and Diplomacy in the Trump Administration, continues in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're airing a selection of comments from a panel discussion last evening that I moderated with Lynn Hicks of the Des Moines Register, hosted by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. The discussion marks Governor Terry Branstad's transition to U.S. ambassador to China. It was titled, China, Iowa, and Diplomacy in the Trump Administration. Panel members included former U.S. ambassadors Mary Kramer and Ron McMullen, Bill Niebuhr, President and CEO of Origin Agritech, and University of Iowa Professor of Political Science and International Studies, Wenfang Tung. In this second part, I began by asking Ambassador McMullen how diplomacy is different under the Trump administration.
President Trump is a multimillionaire who made his fortune in business. And as a result, I think he has a transactional view of diplomacy and international relations, that what are we going to get out of this relationship? You get a little bit and we get more of what we want out of a transactional relationship? In the past, most American presidents have had a values-based a foreign policy to promote American democracy and to uphold human rights, as well as to promote specific U.S. interests in countries and regions of the world. So I was very pleased to hear Governor Branstad say that every day he will represent to the Chinese government and to the Chinese people the importance of American values. And he listed human rights as number one, followed by free and open trade, a rule-based order for the ocean surrounding China, a nod towards the South China Sea, and lastly, free press. So while President Trump hasn't talked much about promoting American values, Governor Branstad did in his hearing yesterday. And also we see that when one of the most striking actions that, no pun intended, that President Trump has ordered was the missile strike on Syria. And it wasn't because of a particular U.S. interest. It was a U.S. value about using chemical weapons. I mean, there was no particular U.S. interest involved in there. It was a humanitarian, institutional, multilateral world agreement that countries won't use chemical weapons. And so Trump's actions don't always match his words. And sometimes his actions are better than his words. Not always, but sometimes. And so we see this mercurial foreign policy, at least now.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that as well, Mary Kramer, as a former ambassador here, that we have such a departure as a president? If you were in the shoes of Governor Branstad, what would be your greatest concerns?
There are congressional comments that resonate around the world that we don't hear about or think about. But my husband was very active in the Rotary Clubs in the Eastern Caribbean. It was perhaps he was a better ambassador than I along those lines. But the idea was he would go to a Rotary meeting and there would be people asking him about something that somebody said on CNN 30 minutes before. And so I think it's always been the case that everything we do and say is out there. On the other hand, as a diplomat, I sort of the you can't hit a smiling face. I really worked at mastering the art of endlessly pleasant, because it just is very difficult, and it's futile to really expect people to do things they do not think are in their best interest.
Wenfeng, yeah.
The two leaders in two countries may have a lot of differences between them. Probably there's one thing I see, at least I see, as they have in common, that is pragmatism. I think the Chinese government and Chinese leadership has been known for being pragmatic, and they are willing to make deals. And the same is true with President Trump. And he's a businessman. He might surprise people with his daily tweets. However, if you think in a business point of view, I sometimes think about the similarity between his book, The Art of Deal Making, and The Art of War by Sun Tzu. You know, there's a lot of similarities there.
If you had a Chinese man with the same personality, let's just try to transpose Donald Trump into China, what would people think of him?
I think people think him as direct.
Bill Niebuhr.
No, I think that's exactly right. The Chinese presidents don't come out of the Iowa caucus, with all due respect to the Iowa caucus. These are individuals that are groomed, and I've had the opportunity to speak to young business professionals during my stay in China and young political professionals. And the two groups couldn't have been more different in terms of their preparations, their educations, and their formations. And this new president is a negotiator, and he's an effective negotiator because you have no idea what he's thinking or what he might do next. Additionally, you really don't know what his BATNA is, his best alternative to no agreement. You don't know his fallback stance. And this has these career politicians very perplexed as they're trying to interpret what went on at our winter White House. It is really right now very unique in its setting. And I think we're all learning, collectively learning, that how this relationship will mature, because it will be very, very different than where it's been for the first half of this decade.
Well, that brings us to the big issue, which Wenfeng talked about earlier, and that is North Korea and this U.S. strategy of putting pressure on China to do something about North Korea, about the missile testing and their nuclear program. Ron, how successful do you think that strategy will be?
Well, I think that right now the Trump administration is counting on Governor Branstad to deliver China on North Korea. I think President...
No pressure.
Yeah. So Wenfeng mentioned that the currency manipulation charge has fallen away. And also, we may, again, the dog that didn't bark. In January, the U.S. Pacific Command asked permission to do a freedom of navigation sail within 12 miles of a reef that China has built into an island illegally. And Washington refused that sail by, that freedom of navigation sail by. So I think even in the South China, the list of hot button issues that Wenfeng mentioned earlier, I think all of them are going to be back issue or back burner issues until we can see if Governor Branstad can deliver China on North Korea. I don't think he's going to be able to. I mean, China does not want a united democratic country allied with the U.S. on its doorstep. It does not want chaos in North Korea with 10 million North Korean refugees fleeing across its border.
Bill Niebuhr, I see you vigorously nodding your head there in agreement, but it is interesting when Ron talks about China's position, how do you see that, the problem from the Chinese perspective?
Well, I think Ron is exactly right. This is such a massive issue that any one individual is able to create some momentum, but to culminate it in the time frames that we're talking about is going to be extraordinarily difficult. And so what I think China recognizes is that this is a problem in their part of the world, but it's on their time frame. And they will respond very quickly. The thing that really impressed me in my time there is that things happen slowly, but when they happen immediately. The response is swift. It's complete, and if it's a problem, it goes away. And so I agree completely with Ron. I think this is a major, major risk factor for this new ambassador in his early days.
Wenfeng.
I would agree with what Ron said about China not tolerating a democratic, unified Korea. But I would frame it slightly differently from the Chinese point of view. The Chinese don't see that as a democratic country. The Chinese would see it as a country under the American influence, American control. That's how they see the threat. If you go back to the Korean War, the reason China entered the Korean War was because the U.S. troops were pushing very close to the Chinese border. So for China, I think the bottom line is it cannot tolerate a Korean peninsula under the American control. I think from the Chinese point of view, the only solution is not military solution. The United States has to sit face to face with North Korea and negotiate.
Okay, and because you've said that you don't think that China is capable of doing what the U.S. wants?
Correct. For the Chinese, I think I think this is Chinese president told President Trump there's a lot of historical animosity between the two countries. Whatever China does is perceived by North Korea as an attempt to control North Korea. So they're very, very, the Chinese government has to be really careful whatever it does.
Right. With a mix of diplomatic expertise and knowledge and experience with China on this panel, also regarding North Korea here, we've all been sort of anxious to one degree, very anxious perhaps, about what we could wake up to tomorrow. How close do you feel we are to really having a military engagement with North Korea? Wang Fong.
I think it's part of the art of deal-making is bluffing more than real, because if you think about it, I'm no military expert, but the border, the 38 parallel is 30 miles, I think, from the South Korean capital, Seoul, and they can use conventional weapons to attack South Korea. So if the U.S. does not have the confidence to wipe out the entire North Korean military power, then they will retaliate. There will be heavy losses in South Korea, possibly in Japan. So I don't see that as an option. So I think negotiation is the only way to solve the problem between the U.S. and North Korea.
Yeah, I think that the North Korea represents really quite a unique situation versus a problematic stand or a dry country in the Middle East or a place where people don't typically go or we don't have population centers. I think that what Wen Fong has just laid out is that you have a technologically incompetent situation here playing with a population center of the world in Japan and the Koreas and China, and this puts it on a completely different plateau as I think about how we need to approach this. And a unilateral sort of after dinner activity would be, I think, very ill advised at this moment into that particular geography. And I'm not sure what others think, but that it's a huge insecurity for me. I couldn't imagine what was going to get me to worry less about Iran and a few other places, but it's emerged.
Wow. Ron, how do you assess the risk?
North Korea has taken provocative actions, seizing the USS Pueblo and launching missiles and doing all kinds of things that I think have to do with securing regime support and regime security in North Korea. The United States and South Korea and Japan and China have all, I think, refrained from rising to the bait. And I hope that President Trump continues to do that in the face of the next provocation. I think throughout the Trump administration, there's a realization that the United States has almost no good options regarding North Korea. You know, as Wen Fong and Bill have said, there are maybe 1,200 conventional artillery tubes built into, dug into stone cliffs that could level Seoul, a city of 20 million people, in you know, a three-hour barrage. So I think that's why the hope is that maybe Governor Branstad can deliver China to solve our North Korea problem. It's the only good, and that's not really a very plausible option, but it's the only option that anybody, I think, focuses on right now with some hope of success. I think it's misplaced, frankly. Can I say that whole North Korea issue is more urgent but less important than the U.S.-China bilateral relationship?
Yes. Explain what you mean by that.
I mean, we could have an incident tomorrow or tonight as we're speaking here that puts American lives and security at risk in the Korean Peninsula. But as some of us said, the relationship with China, getting it right now, as China is a rising power seeking to take its place in global affairs, getting that right now will have more to have a bigger influence on the 21st century prosperity and peace in America than any other relationship. And so maybe we could look at Korea as being a symptom of the China-U.S. relationship. Can we cooperate? Can we find a way to cooperate to corral this rogue nation without destroying a very prosperous and strategically important corner of the world?
Great point. All right. We are almost out of time, and so I'd like to wrap up by having our panelists sum up some final thoughts, starting with Winfong. What are your hopes and fears in U.S.-China relations going forward?
Everyone says that China and U.S. are so important, two important countries, and they are so closely related, codependent with each other. They cannot live without each other. But I would be a little more pessimistic. I would like to point out some barriers between these two countries. One barrier I can see is cultural difference. China has a long Confucian tradition. This culture is very much group-oriented culture. In Western society, it's a liberal, individualistic culture. So these two different sets of values would be in conflict with each other. The second problem between the two countries is political. And the U.S. has to go through this electoral cycle, right? Frequent change of leadership and change of foreign policy, but the Chinese system focuses more on stability and continuity. So that's going to be another problem dealing with the two countries. The third one, I think, is the one some of the panelists referred to. That is the problem of a rising new power and old power being in control of the world order. Right? And the new power sometimes doesn't want to play the rules according to the existing power. So how do you deal with this? How to keep this balance would be another problem.
Bill Niebuhr, your concluding remarks here. Hopes and fears, I guess.
The thing I guess I've been impressed by in my working career and my life is that the haves have a certain perspective and the have-nots have another. And it is to our advantage to move as many people globally as we can to the have status, and in a way that is environmentally responsible, and I think ecologically and humanistically appropriate. And so my worry is that we continue to play the ally versus the adversary, as the question was posed yesterday in the hearings. We have to accept that we're both. We aspire to do things that each of us want to do, and that to achieve that, it's not zero sum. It can be that we win-win. So I have my fears, but my optimism far outweighs my insecurity.
Mary Kramer, I see you nodding at Bill's
yes.
optimism.
I share that optimism. I always think that the best is yet to come, and I also subscribe to something I call the theory of abundance, which means that if we actually believe in and act on that we are all better if everyone has an opportunity to rise, if all boats rise, then the pie gets bigger, and it's not just the game of how are you going to cut it, because if it stays the same, if my piece gets bigger, yours is going to get smaller.
And I think the final word goes to you, Ron McMullen.
Thank you. I'm wearing a little lapel pin here that's got Iowa and the United States cross flags. So what's in this for Iowa? In the spirit of the Trump administration's business orientation, I'd like to lay down a marker for Governor Branstad. And this is it, $490 million. That's how much Iowa exported to China last year. $490 million sounds like a lot. It was out of a total Iowa export base of $12 billion. Canada imports way more from Iowa than China does. Mexico imports way more from Iowa than China does. Japan, 100 million Japanese, imports way more from Iowa than China does. So in 3 years, at the 3 years into the Branstad ambassadorship to Iowa, if we're not exporting more than $490 million worth of materials to China, then maybe it hasn't been all that good.
Something to follow up on. Thank you all.
A selection of comments from a panel discussion last evening on the University of Iowa campus titled China, Iowa, and Diplomacy in the Trump Administration. Panel members included former U.S. Ambassadors Ron McMullen and Mary Kramer, Bill Niebuhr of Origin AgriTech, and University of Iowa Professor of Political Science and International Studies, Wenfang Tang. Many thanks to our co-sponsors of this event, Des Moines Register and the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Jim Davies was our sound engineer. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.